Dive into Six Music on the BBC Sounds app and discover all our latest shows, sessions and mixes.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
I'm Matt Everett and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. My guest today is an undeniable rock and roll legend. As the founder, songwriter and vocalist of Creedence Clearwater Revival, he's sold an incredible 100 million records worldwide. He's been inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and despite celebrating his 80th birthday not that long ago, his songs with Creedence continue to find new audiences. Three have had over 1 billion streams. He headlined Woodstock and became a figurehead for the 60s activist movement, speaking out against the Vietnam War and social injustice. And even recently, he's found himself going head-to-head with Donald Trump. I'm extremely proud to welcome to The First Time today, John Fogerty. And you just heard the Creedence Clearwater Revival classic, Fortunate Son, from 1969. In this show, our conversation covers John's first forays into songwriting at a precocious young age, falling in love with rock and roll, and how he was drafted, then discharged, from the military. We also, of course, cover the incredible worldwide success of Creedence Clearwater Revival and their staggering work rate. Their debut came out in 1968, then they did three albums in 69 and two more in 1970, and the pressures that he put upon himself to deliver the music. He discusses the breakup of the band in 1972 and also the years of hard legal battles he undertook trying to regain ownership of his own songs. A shocking record deal early in his career meant that John didn't own the rights to his music for almost his entire career. But now, with those songs back with their author and a new album of new versions of his classic tracks recently released, he is back playing live, doing shows including this year's Glastonbury and a handful of very rare interviews, of which this is one. And I started by asking John, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music as a child?
I was quite young. I'm sure before I was two. But my mother actually told me that when I was still in her belly, she went to a Beethoven concert and I was kicking up a storm. When I was little, I used to say, yeah, I wanted to get the heck out of here. But I probably enjoyed it. She said I was very active. My mother knew Beethoven, you know. So, there you go.
And the first thing that you owned was a record, wasn't it? The very first thing as a
child. That's right. When I was 3 years old, my mom sat me down and kind of made a little ceremony. She presented me with one of those children records that were yellow back in the day. And she said, I'm going to give this record to you. And she played both sides. One side was Oh Susanna, one side was Camptown Races. And then she explained to me that Stephen Foster was the songwriter of both songs. And I just absorbed that. You know, all through my life, I've wondered what my mom had in mind. It's so unusual to talk to a child about the songwriter. You know, kids love music. They hear all the little ditties that they'll sing when even before they know what the words mean. And here I was being told of a sort of backstory behind the curtain. Anyway, I'm really glad she did that. I've been noticing Stephen Foster all my life and his style, that sort of thing, that very Americana kind of lilt to the music, and I imagine it influenced me quite a bit.
Did you listen to the radio a lot? Was that something in your home that was quite kind of predominant?
Yes, I was very aware. As a very young person, my parents separated somewhere around when I was 8 years old. But before that, anyway, I remember hearing all those songs that we now call the hit parade, things by Patti Page and I think Tony Bennett was even way back there, you know, all that sort of music. How much is that doggy in the window, you know?
Yeah.
I was aware of that stuff. And also, my parents were musical. I remember being very young and driving kind of on vacation, sitting between them in the front seat. They would sing and harmonize.
Okay.
What are you guys doing? I hear two notes. And my mom explained, oh, Johnny, we're harmonizing. And I thought, oh, there was this extra thing that went along with the main melody. And I kind of absorbed that too. I think the music was so around me that it was just natural. The radio was always on. There wasn't much TV then. You know, that's how far back this is. And later, as my older brothers started tuning into rhythm and blues, and that was a whole new ball game.
Who was the rhythm and blues artist that you latched onto first?
Well, I remember hearing Muddy Waters. I remember a little bit of Louis Jordan. You know, I think some people think that's bebop or whatever, but he was played a lot on this R&B station. Yeah, things like that were very big sounding, you know, imposing, I think is what I would use. A little bit later, I heard Howlin' Wolf, and that, oh my goodness, yeah, that was scary, actually.
Your first guitar?
Well, when I was really little, we had an old Stella guitar around the house. I'm very proud of that tradition now. We used to think it was sort of a, I don't know, I mean, put it this way, my older brother told me later in life, he said, you know, we used to play baseball with that thing. And we'd hit balls with it, you know, bam. Very stout, and the strings were about that high. You know, it was really hard to play. But lo and behold, it turned out Stellas were sort of the blues band's choice back in the 30s and 40s. Yeah, because they were cheap, and they were very strong. Leadbelly played a Stella 12-string. You know, without knowing it, I was kind of part of that tradition that was a place I really loved being.
Yeah. What was the first song you learned to play on this guitar? Can you remember?
Well, I took some folk guitar lessons with my mom. My mother loved folk music. And way early on, I remember her playing songs like Sal Got the Measles and She Died in the Spring, things like that. As I got a little older, I came to know that my mother really loved Pete Seeger, and I adopted that myself. He was wonderful. My mom took me to see Pete Seeger. It's got to be 10, 15 times, I suppose.
Wow.
But the first song I actually remember playing, I had an electric guitar, and it was a song called Endless Sleep by Jody Reynolds.
Right.
It was something on the radio, and nobody showed me what to do. I figured out the kind of hammering on an E chord was sort of like the effect that Jody had on this song with a whammy bar going boom, 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 right? And I would hammer on my chord and just sing that first verse over and over again. I was, you know, usually all by myself in the house so I could get away with it.
The night was black, rain falling down. Look for my baby. She's nowhere around. Traced her footsteps down to the shore. Afraid she's gone forevermore. I looked at the sea and it seemed the same. I took your baby from you away. I heard a voice crying in the deep. Come join me, baby, in my endless sleep. Why did I leave her alone tonight? That's why her footsteps ran into the sea. That's why my baby has gone from me. I looked at the sea and it seemed to say, I took your baby from you away. I heard a voice crying in the deep. Come join me, baby, in my endless sleep. Ran in the water, heart full of fear. There in the break, I saw her near. Reached for my darling, held her to me. Stole her.
And you've talked about songwriting. This was your focus. You had like tunnel vision.
Well, I knew I wanted to make music, but I started making music before I'd really found a direction or anything. Somewhere around that, I was 8 years old in the third grade, and I heard an advertisement on this rhythm and blues station, and the guy on the radio said, "Do you have the Wash Day Blues?" And I'm sure he was selling some kind of laundry soap, you know. But that phrase stuck in my head. So from that moment all the way walking to school, I was creating a song called Wash Day Blues, of course. And, you know, I'd be singing to myself, "I got the Wash Day Blues." Dun, 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 dun. And I would do that with my mouth, make that sound. Dun, 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 dun. "Oh, I don't want to have these Wash Day Blues." Dun, 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 dun. Well, that was the old Muddy Waters, Willie Dixon riff that I was very aware of from different songs. So that was natural as can be to me, just starting to make up a song. Later, I looked back and went, oh, wow, I was already starting to figure out how to put things together to make a song.
Yeah. What was the first performance that you gave, the first kind of gig that you did?
Well, before I was actually playing an instrument, a buddy of mine in grammar school named Bob Carlton we were pantomiming records, comedy records, most notably Stan Freberg records.
Yeah.
It was kind of like Weird Al. Stan liked to make fun of rock and roll and pop music, so he would do a funny version. He's doing The Great Pretender, right? And the producer or whatever is telling this guy, you got to play that cling, cling, cling jazz or you don't get paid tonight, right? And suddenly you hear a big crash and glass crinkling. He says, what did you do? I came through the window. It was, you know, so we learned to mouth all the words that were on the records, and we did it in front of our classmates. So we had a repertoire of like 8 or 10 different songs that we would perform that way.
Well, all right, to me is this feeling of make believe. You see how lovely that turned out now? That's a darling part. Appreciate it. And gay like a clown.
Jumping forward a bit, there's so many legends about your time when you joined the army. As a songwriter, that was not necessarily the place for you. And you realised that pretty quickly, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about how you manoeuvred yourself.
I was drafted during the Vietnam time. So, I mean, most young men really didn't want to get drafted and go to a jungle somewhere far away and get shot at, and for no reason that anybody could understand.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the mindset of young guys then. I ended up getting into a Army Reserve unit, which was better for me because it meant I didn't go overseas. I did my active duty in the States. But one of the phenomenons, they had millions of people in uniform, at least this is the way I look at it, and they didn't know what to do with everybody for, you know, 8 hours a day or 10 or 12 hours a day. So we did a lot of marching, and I was somewhere on the East Coast in the summertime. It was either Fort Lee or Fort Knox. Anyway, we would be marching and marching, and it was above 100 by the temperature. But coming off that asphalt, this parade field, they called it, it was just a mile square of asphalt. And it was, had to be 130 degrees coming off of that. We'd, you know, after lunch every day, they'd march us, right, for maybe 2-3 hours. At some point, I started hallucinating. You know, you're marching along, there's not a lot to think about. Boom. No, yo left, yo left, yo left, right, left. Okay, everybody, right, pace, and you go off that way, you know. And so my brain just started going somewhere else, and I was not here anymore. And in that circumstance, I started writing a narrative, which turned into a song. And it had to do with partly my own real life, especially as a child, especially the conditions or the feelings between me and my dad. The fact that my parents split up and all that, my dad became alcoholic. And so there was a lot of, you know, unpleasant thoughts, let's say, connected with it. And so in my little narrative, my dad gets picked up by the authorities and taken away. It wasn't true, but I was kind of making a story. In other words, I was using my own feelings and then sometimes taking poetic license. Well, this went on for weeks. I actually started to look forward to the marching because I would tune into this radio or whatever it was in my head. And by the end of it, I realized I had written a song. I came home off active duty that summer, 1967, and I realized I had created a song about those times. And I really liked what I had done because it was a story. It sort of had meat on the bones, you know? It was much thicker and deeper than the typical rock and roll, oh, Betty Lou, you make me blue. Why did you do this to me? You know, and I retained that. I was kind of excited about it. Eventually, I named that thing Porterville, even though I don't say Porterville anywhere in the song, but it just seemed to fit the mood of the song. And so from then on, I kind of wanted to stick with that. That was my approach to songwriting.
Yeah.
Been an awful long time since I've been home.
You've talked a lot about your love of the Beatles.
Yeah.
What's the Beatles song that we should play, and why should we play it at this point in the interview?
Well, I think my favorite is In My Life.
Why that song?
Well, what happens when people ask you a question like that? I go right back to the way I felt when I first heard that song. Now, there were many, many more great Beatle songs after that, and I love them all. You know, and I could probably say those, but In My Life to me was so astounding. The Beatles were having quite a career in pop music. You know, I'd grown up through all the early rock and roll era, kind of just like them, of course. And suddenly here was this song that had a lot more meaning, and it had this sort of wistful, melancholy sound to it. And I thought it was quite startling. So I remember just thinking, wow, they've really done something here.
There are places I remember.
Talk about Susie Q, which was the first Creedence single, and you mentioned this before, like it wasn't an instant hit, was it? It didn't happen straight away.
Well, we actually had made Susie Q to be a way to get our foot in the door. There was a local station in the Bay Area called KMPX. It later became very legendary. It was the first, quote, underground station. Each DJ had kind of a free form to play whatever he wanted. Of course, that really meant he played a lot of rock and roll, but also a lot of, let's say, soul music. Stax Records was very prominent. And sometimes even some old blues, you know, country blues. And, you know, there was one DJ that was playing some Tibetan monk music and all that, you know, quite strange. Occasionally that station would play a tape by a band that wasn't even a record, that wasn't published. And I had just come home from my active duty, and I really kind of, well, this idea of making a tape that would go right on the radio was fascinating. And so I determined that, you know what, I'm not going to try and write a new song. I'm going to pick an old song that I already know is really good and then put the psychedelic treatment to it and a jam. That would seem to be what this station preferred. And so that's exactly what happened. I took Susie Q because I'd loved that from the time I was a kid. I loved the guitar lick. And then we practiced that song a lot, over and over. I mean, for months, literally. And I made, eventually, when it came to time to record, I made a road map because I don't read music. So I took a bunch of pieces of binder paper and taped them together, you know, so that it would be about 3 feet long, something like that, and kind of went from the left to the right, kind of like a car journey from California to Georgia, you know, except it was the song. And I pointed out at each place what was going to happen in the song. And that kind of organized my thoughts, and I stuck with that as I presented the arrangement to the band, and that's what we recorded. Actually got permission from Fantasy Records to go in and make this record, and, you know, it turned out really well. In other words, it was exactly what you hear on the first Creedence album. And the remarkable thing is we took it to the radio station and they started playing it. And it ended up being played by each of the DJs. So it was probably played 6, 7, 8 times a day, which was, you know, we were an unknown group. That was phenomenal. And that airplay, number one, it led to us being able to make an album. And it then sort of crossed over to other stations once there was an official album. And finally, it crossed over to top 40. I don't know if anybody else expected it to do that, but that's kind of what I was hoping for all along. And that was a great idea.
I've got to ask you about Proud Mary, because there's some songs, and you've written a few of them, that kind of belong to the world, really.
Thank you.
And that's definitely one of them. I mean, obviously, the Ike and Tina version is incredible, but there's something about your original raw version. When you got it down, were you like, this is okay, this is firing on all cylinders?
Well, that was a magical day. Of course, ever since my mother had told me about Stephen Foster, I'd been paying attention to songwriters. You know, she would talk about the people that she loved, like Hoagie Carmichael, who I ended up really liking. And some of the movie people like Harold Arlen, you know, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And then I started noticing the songwriters, you know, of the music I liked early on. Of course, Lieber and Stoller, I was a big fan of them. I was trying to write songs, but I was aware that, I guess, there's you organize things in your mind. And some things are just really high on the mountain, just really great. One day I'm going into my apartment and I find my honorable discharge sitting on the stairs, my discharge from the Army, something that I dearly had hoped for. And it was wonderful news. I was so relieved and happy, overjoyed, euphoric, I think is the word. And I went right in the house and started strumming on my guitar. The first words out of my mouth once I finally started singing some words was, left a good job in the city, working for the man every night and day. Well, obviously, I'd just gotten out of the Army. That was what inspired that.
Left a good job in the city, working for the man every night and day. Then I never lost a minute of sleep, and playing back the way things might have been. This wheel will keep on turning, crime will keep on burning, rolling, rolling, rolling on the river.
I'm strumming my guitar. I think I had finally come up with the phrase, rolling, rolling, rolling on the river, you know, and I, wow, that's nice, but what the heck is this thing? So I went to my little notebook that I had started, oh, a few months before. I opened the notebook, and lo and behold, the first line, the very top of the page, the first thing I ever put in that book was the phrase, Proud Mary. But I didn't know what it meant when I did it. I just, okay, I wrote it down because that's why I got the little notebook, right? But as I sat there strumming and looking at the page, I came to realize, oh, Proud Mary is the name of a riverboat. That's what this song's about. Okay, it really did its job. The whole process of writing in the book and then having it there at the time I needed it. What I really didn't discover until quite recently or remember, at the bottom of that same page, the first page in the book, at the very last thing at the bottom is the word riverboat. So I must have, you know, looked at that page and seen that somehow, even if I just skipped over it. And somewhere in my mind, I connected Proud Mary and riverboat and began to make the song that way.
You're obsessed.
Yes.
By songwriting, because like the debut album in 68, three albums in 69, two in 1970. Was that what you did every single day? Just write?
Yeah, absolutely. I just thought it was my job. At the end of 68, I kind of was taking stock of my situation, and I realized, well, we've had a hit, Susie Q. So we don't have a manager. We don't have a publicist. We're on a tiny label, and it's a jazz label, and these people don't know anything about rock and roll. And I said, man, we're a one-hit wonder. And that was really scary to me because, you know, there are lots of those. And for whatever reason, they don't continue. You never hear of them again. So I would work, you know, my daily routine was I would meet with the band and rehearse around noon for a couple hours and then maybe go do an errand or something, then go home and have dinner. And in the evening, starting about 7:30, 8 o'clock, I would start writing songs and I'd be up till about 4 in the morning. Every single day, because, I mean, what else was I going to do? This was life and death, you might say.
Because on all those records, I'm specifically thinking about Cosmos Factory. I'm thinking about Heard It Through the Grapevine. There's a sound that musicians make when the chemistry is right. It's just in that moment. And the groove is happening because there's not a lot of overdubs. Each instrument sounds great. The production is really clear, really solid. But there's just a feel to those records that's just so... It's kind of a beautiful thing. I think that's why people keep coming back to them. The songwriting's great and the performances are just so locked in.
Well, that was a very important ingredient. I remember that the trio, the Blue Velvets, that would be Doug and Stu and myself in high school, we played for a class reunion that was people from way before our time. And I know one of the songs we played was Green Onions. And this fella came over. I didn't realize he was, what's the word? It wasn't insulting us, but he was just sort of giving us the brutal facts. But he didn't present it that way. We had just played Green Onions. We're probably about 17 years old. And he says, you know, boys, there's just something missing. What he was saying in his very gentle way is that we kind of didn't have the feeling. He didn't have the swing, right? I'm sure the thing probably sounded pretty straight and kind of herky-jerky. Somewhere in what he was saying, I understood. And as I got to be a little older, I noticed when you really communicate with your insides, you refuse to not be swinging. You refuse to play something that doesn't have that feel. But that takes a little work, I think. In other words, Blue Velvets were mostly an instrumental band, and so we would play things like Wipeout, right? And Wipeout is a classic teenage rock and roll instrumental from those days. It's a guitar song, but it's pretty straight ahead. There's no inside the groove kind of feel. It just goes, you know, it's, yeah. And then if you go listen to a Fats Domino record, or a Little Richard record, oh my gosh, Earl Palmer, and other things like that, certainly Howlin' Wolf, or some fellas that really became my idol, Booker T and the MGs. And everything they did had that feeling. And you realize that they could play something that was basically just an E chord, but because that feeling was there, it was really interesting. So that was something that we concentrated on a lot after a certain point in our development, because it seemed like without that, without that, you're just missing something. And that's what happened.
I know you've been asked about Woodstock a lot. Because for me, I'm like, there's the image and there's the legend and there's probably the reality of what it was like doing it. On tape, it's a great performance, man. There's like, but I just wondered if you remember it being like as magical as everyone says it was, or whether on the stage it was like hard work.
Well, by that time, Creedence was really playing very well.
Yeah.
And the standard, my standard, because I was the leader, you know, there were no drugs or alcohol or anything. We're going to be right here in the moment, not on vacation. And what happened at Woodstock, it had rained for a day and a half or something like that. And there was a lot of mud around, and the people were, well, put it this way. On the night I was supposed to play at 8 o'clock, things just got later and later and later. So somewhere around midnight, the Grateful Dead went on stage. They played for a little while, and then the stage went silent, and we're sitting in a trailer probably about a half mile away. Oh, must be our time. And somebody comes and says, no, the Dead's still on stage. I remember thinking, or even saying, well, what are they doing? I don't know. The Grateful Dead had taken LSD just as they walked on stage in front of a half a million people. Personally, I don't have that sort of, what's the word, confidence in the universe to do something like that. And so sure enough, you know, predictably, everything sort of kicked in at a certain point, and then they were lost on stage. And what ended up happening was all these people, this legendary half a million people in the audience who had been rained on, hadn't been able to get enough food, certainly not enough water, were out in the elements, were muddy, and were tired. They chose that time to go to sleep. So finally the Dead came off stage, and Creedence went on. I've always said it was around 2:30 in the morning. Come running out ready to, you know, kick butt and really be great. And there's no reaction. It's really kind of disappointing. You come out and, I mean, it's almost silence. And then, okay, we start playing our songs, you know, and we play 3-4 songs. I actually went up to the microphone and said, well, you know, we're having a good time up here. We're playing our hearts out for you. We sure hope you're enjoying this, having a good time. And somebody way, you know, because all I see in the, like, 3 or 4 feet in front of the stage is all you can see in the technology of lighting in those days. They're all asleep. That's all I see. But way back there in the dark somewhere, some guy's got his lighter out, you know, he's doing this. And I hear him say, don't worry about it, John. We're with you. So, you know, I ended up playing the whole rest of my show to that guy. That was what was in my mind. But we, how can I say it? We didn't fall apart. We were used to soldiering through and playing well. They sent me a tape of our performance of Bad Moon and said, well, we're going to make a movie about Woodstock. It was good, you know, it kind of sounded like the record, but there was no reaction or anything around it. And so I declined. Happily, you know, all these years later, they released the whole album of Woodstock. You can hear it now.
Don't go around tonight. Well, it's bound to take your life.
Listening to so many of your songs and the versions that you've done for this new record, you've gone back and you've revisited some of the classic songs and you're still moving forward, you're still playing shows, there's momentum. Looking back on Creedence and the work that you did, and obviously it didn't end in the best possible way, how do you feel about that body of work you did then?
Oh, I think it's wonderful. I do admit that because it ended so badly, particularly from the record company, there was a long time that my feelings were very confused, and probably there was anger, but mostly I was hurt. I was just in a place where it kind of damaged my creativity.
Yeah.
And so those were unpleasant times to think about. If one of the Creedence records would come on the radio in the car, I'd probably change the channel, you know, kind of, geez. But, you know, my life is very happy now. I've married a wonderful girl, Julie, and we have a lovely family. And slowly, through love, I began to feel, you know, so much better. And I also realize I'm a very lucky man. This is just a very lucky thing to have happened to me. And that helped me to feel better about things. You know, you mentioned Grapevine, you know, that there is a wonderful groove on that record and many of the other songs because, how can I say it, that was very important to me. You know, I kept practicing and instructing and trying to get the best out of people until it became a fact that that was an ingredient in our band. All those records that were made during that period of about 2 years, I suppose, before things really went south, of course, I'm very proud of that time. The songs are wonderful. I still maintain and always will, it's the song, it's the song, you know? But I'm very happy that the records are really good.
Quick legendary story. Is it true, in the late 80s, you hadn't been playing Creedence live, and it was Bob Dylan and George Harrison that said, look, you should do this. Is that a legend or is it true? Because if it's true, I need to know that story.
Yeah, true. Well, you know, I mentioned feeling kind of angry and hurt about the songs from that era. I literally stopped playing Creedence songs, which are really, of course, John Fogerty songs, but they were played by the band Creedence. Over a period of about 25 years, I only played them 3 times. And this story you're talking about is one of them. So I was deep into a time when I was not playing the Creedence era songs, my most famous songs at the time, went to a club in the L.A. area called the Palomino. It's a pretty famous place. I had gone there to see Taj Mahal, who I love. And it turns out that, you know, I started hearing rumors that George Harrison was there and Bob Dylan was there. And it's another story, so I won't go into it. But I got to spend some time talking with George Harrison, and that was wonderful. And then I went back to my seat, and Bob and George were sort of hiding in the dressing room. I was watching Taj Mahal up on stage, and suddenly Taj does a little riff. I knew what he was doing right away, so he's playing Here Comes the Sun, and he's calling up George Harrison. oh, wow, this is going to be cool. I mean, sitting there, I'm watching this. And so George gets up there and he's playing with Taj. And then Taj looks around and he calls up Bob Dylan. So Bob goes up there and they're, you know, Bob and George had arrived together. They're friends, right? They're having a good time up there on stage. And I'm thinking to myself, God dang, I sure hope they got one more guitar because I want to be up there with those people. And sure enough, Taj called me up to be on stage. And so we're up there kind of fumbling around, you know, and eventually I think the audience maybe was requesting things because, you know, it's a club. It's pretty informal. And so George suddenly rips into Honey Don't. He starts playing the riff and it's just outrageously great. And we all play Honey Don't.
Well, how come you say you will when you won't? Say you do, baby, when you don't. Let me know, honey, how you feel. Tell the truth, how is love real? But well, honey, don't. Well, honey, don't. Honey, don't. Honey, don't. Honey, don't. I say you will when you won't. Honey, don't. Baby, and you ought to know, I like the way that you wear your clothes. Everything about you is so doggone sweet. You got that sand all over your feet. But well, honey, don't. Honey, don't. Honey, don't. Honey, don't. Honey, don't. I say you will when you won't. Honey, don't. Rock on, George, one time for me. Saturday night, Sunday morning, you don't look right. You've been out painting the town, baby, been stepping around. Well, well, honey, don't. I said, honey, don't. Honey, don't. Honey, don't. Honey, don't. I say you will when you won't. I'll rock on George Baringo one time.
Then we kind of veer into a Bob Dylan song, and for the life of me, I can't remember what the song was. I'm almost ashamed to say, God, how could you not remember that? But I actually don't. And then somebody in the audience, John, play Proud Mary. Bob is over on my left, and I kind of look at him, and I'm off mic, but I'm kind of looking that way, and I go, I don't play those songs. And the guy, come on, John, play Proud Mary. And, you know, I'm just shaking my head. It's a really awkward moment if I think about it, but I was so bullheaded, or whatever the word would be, I had made up my mind. I don't do that. And then Bob from, you know, my left turns to face me. And I see him say, yeah, John, if you don't play Proud Mary, everybody's going to think it's a Tina Turner song. And it was such a throwdown, right? And he's Bob Dylan. There was no getting out of this. I had to do it. Luckily, I did, and we all played Proud Mary, and I'm so glad that moment happened. Now, the legend is that, oh, and that freed my heart, and from then on I started playing the song. No, that actually didn't happen that way. This, to me, was in my mind a one-off, and I really didn't make up my mind to start playing the songs again. until a very fateful day. I was down in Mississippi standing at the grave of Robert Johnson.
I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees. I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees. Had a lot of burn by myself.
Robert Johnson was a big star right then. He had a collection, a CD package of all his songs out, and I'm sure it was number one maybe. And I got to thinking in this hot sun, well, I wonder who owns Robert's songs. And then I realized, because of the way of the music biz, I said to myself, probably some lawyer up in a tall building with a big cigar up in New York or someplace. And that disgusted me, you know, and I said it out loud. That's terrible. I said, it doesn't matter, Robert. The whole world knows, and I'm talking out loud now. The whole world knows these songs are your songs, Robert. And those words just sort of left my mouth and were hanging from a big tree there. And I just said to myself, John, you got to start playing your songs before you're laying in the ground here like Robert. And that's actually the moment when it happened.
It's been so lovely to speak to you. What should we finish the show on? What song should we play to play us out?
I'm going to play or ask you to play the song that sort of made me decide I wanted to play guitar and make records. And that was My Baby Left Me by Elvis Presley.
Then that's the song we should go out on. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you. Thank you
for being here.
That was My Baby Left Me
by Elvis, the final choice of my guest on the first time, John Fogerty from Creedence Clearwater Revival. And thank you so much to John for finding time to be our guest. And that's the end of this show. I'll be back with another brand new episode of The First Time next week. And you can, of course, listen back to previous First Time shows from this season on BBC Sounds, which include episodes with Jim Moyer, also known as Vic Reeves, Ezra Furman, and Skin from Skunk Anansie. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.